people are shot Sunday in the shadow of TIAA Bank Field during the Jaguars game. That sobering news leads us off this morning as we are live from Studio 5 here on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And coming up, more violence in the city puts increasing pressure on our local leadership. You can join the show now at 549-2937. Then later, the candidates for Florida governor debated last night on CNN. Did you watch? Who do you think came out on top? We'll tell you about a new app that can help you get in touch with your local and federal officials. Plus, Blake Bortles gets benched. Say that three times fast. Blake Bortles gets benched as the Jaguars lose at home. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, as the Jaguars were losing at home Sunday, six people were shot just a few blocks from the stadium. News of the violence went global during the CNN debate that aired last night between Florida gubernatorial candidates Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis. Here's Gillum.
What Florida voters understand is that communities will experience crime. Just in Jacksonville earlier today, six people shot. The question is, what are we going to do about it?
Exactly. Now, the recent spate of violence in the city is especially politically charged to putting new heat on Mayor Lenny Curry and Sheriff Mike Williams, both of whom campaigned on increasing public safety, yet gun violence continues unabated in Jacksonville. Now, at the same time, the city is coming in for some criticism for taking hurricane relief funds from the United Arab Emirates, a country with a shoddy human rights record. Parvez Ahmed is director of graduate programs and professor of finance at UNF's Coggin College of Business. Good morning, Dr. Ahmed. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa.
Give us a call as we talk about the shooting Sunday just a few blocks from the football stadium. The number to join us, 549-2937. Send tweets to @MelissaInJax, emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We're also going to look into that UAE money that's been given to the city and the latest on the investigation into the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Okay, let's begin with the shooting Sunday. We've long been the state's murder capital. However, just the persistent drumbeat of gun violence has just bedeviled multiple administrations in this city, including the current one, Mayor Lenny Curry. You know, it even came up in the gubernatorial debate last night on CNN. And one of the candidates says the question is, what are we going to do about it? Jacksonville is now looking at putting together a task force to address the problem of violent crime. That raised some eyebrows because over 10 years ago, the city did this. It was called the Jacksonville Journey, and it exhaustively looked at the causes of crime, what to do about crime, how to bring the crime rate down, how to make neighborhoods safer, how to strengthen families, how to help kids after school, how to help people coming out of prison, the whole nine yards, and yet a new task force on this. Why?
Well, because we are avoiding the fundamental question. And the fundamental question in my mind is guns. It's the cause of the shootings. It is what causes the mayhem, the deaths and the injuries. And there is no comprehensive push either nationally or even Florida-wide, although some things were done after Parkland. Things like universal background check. 97% of Americans should support some form of a universal background check. Nothing has been done about it. 7 in 10 Americans want a nationwide ban on assault weapons, including 43% of Republicans. And yet there is no action on it. Yet there is this push after Parkland to arm the teachers. Well, only less than 38% of teachers want arming of themselves to protect the schools. We look at, in every way, the gun violence that we experience as Americans is exceptional in the world. That is not one of the reasons why we should be an exceptional nation. And it is not that other countries don't have gun ownership. Other countries have gun ownership. But the rate of gun ownership and the unregulated nature of that gun ownership creates public safety. And we keep on, I have written this article that was published a few months ago, I think after Parkland in Folio, where I asked a provocative question. Is it time for us to rethink or to think about repealing the Second Amendment. I know most people would get sticker shock listening to it, but it is a reasonable question to ask.
But how do you, now let's, whether it's the Second Amendment or any amendment to the Constitution, mm-hmm. let's look at the history of that. That is not something that Americans have typically been amenable to doing, particularly that amendment. You know, the First Amendment and the Second Amendment, more than any other, I think Americans will defend to the end. They just see those as bedrock American values, whether you agree or not with strong Second Amendment proponents. That is such a bone deep value that people that care about gun rights hold. So I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, what do you think about the approaches others have taken to legislate a way to at least reduce the easy flow and availability of guns, including illegal guns?
There are some examples of that without repealing the Second Amendment. Some states have experimented with greater regulation of guns, and those states have seen a drop in deaths related to guns. There is a path to get to public safety and yet preserve the Second Amendment. But if the Second Amendment, in my view at least, if the Second Amendment is a roadblock to reasonable gun regulation, then I don't think we should stop a conversation on it. The Constitution is not a death wish. I remember this after 9/11 when I used to go around and talk about civil liberties, which were being challenged after 9/11 through a variety of government overreach measures. And I would bring up the Constitution, and I would have people who are on the conservative side of the political debate would often say, well, the Constitution is not a death wish. So, well, the same argument should apply now. The Constitution is not a death wish. And a conservative columnist, Bret Stephens, in 2017 wrote the same opinion. He said that tinkering at the margins of gun regulation will not end our national nightmare of mass shootings and exceptionally high rates of gun-related deaths. So it is, there is no easy path to get to a repeal of a constitutional amendment, and I understand that. But it's certainly a reasonable question to ask.
Lots of calls on this. We'll take a few of your calls on the gun violence in Jacksonville over the weekend. Then we're going to move on and talk about another issue, Jacksonville's UAE money for hurricane relief. Okay, I think we have a neighbor on the line of one of the shooting victims. Good morning. Can you give your name?
I'm not going to give my name, but I will tell you I'm a frequent caller, and I usually call the whole politician of the task.
Uh-huh.
But this time, the topic hit kind of home. It's a nuanced situation, number one, with the gun violence. You can't legislate gun violence. Criminals have no regard for the law. If someone has a desire to obtain a gun, they're going to get a gun. I don't care how many background checks you on me. Number two, watching some of these kids grow up and knowing the violence that's going on, the police know exactly who's doing it. Sometimes it's the same perpetrator from previous, you know, and it's difficult living out here and watching these things go on and knowing that resources are being directed away from programs that help stop some of these things. You see these boys walk up and down the street all day, nowhere to go, no jobs, nothing else to do. I mean, where do we draw the line when it comes to the point where we have to look at our elected officials and the government and the things that they do to help put these things in order?
I gotcha. And thanks for calling. I appreciate all of that. And so this does bring more pressure on the city, the mayor, the sheriff, both of whom campaigned successfully on doing a better job than had been done in the past of securing public safety. Yet as the in the Jacksonville Journey era, a number of programs were put in place to help youngsters who didn't have prospects, didn't have anything to do after school, and most of that money for those budgets got cut.
Yes, certainly that's a challenge. And cutting those necessary social programs did not reduce gun violence. So the question then becomes, you know, not only you have to continue to expend the money on necessary social programs like Jacksonville Journey, but also look at ways in which guns can be regulated.
Ben on the South Side. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I just want to call in. Your guest assertion that guns cause violence is just hilarious to me. There's almost 200 million guns in America right now. Guns cause violence. We'd have a lot more violence, wouldn't we? The causes of gun violence tend to be, you know, your socio-economical issues, your
jump in and say that it is a fact that the U.S. is an outlier when it comes to gun violence. That's simply not in dispute.
We also have the
easiest availability of guns of any developed nation in the world. We have more guns per person than any developed country on earth. That is a fact.
It absolutely is a fact. But because of that, the idea that guns cause violence is ridiculous.
Well, I think what he is arguing is that if they were harder for people to get, there'd be less gun violence.
Yeah,
gun violence, but they will still be violent.
Sure.
Sure.
You see, in the UK, you have insane gun control, but what you're also seeing is you're seeing a huge rise in stabbings and other violent crime.
Yeah, but you can't kill 53 people with a knife. You can kill 53 people with a gun, like the guy did in Las Vegas.
In China, where a man hacked a bunch of a school up with a machete and killed.
But there's,
40 people,
but so. You know, there's simply no comparison between the kind of violence you're talking about in the UK and the kind of carnage that we've seen in this country over the last, even the last couple of years. The Pulse shooting in Orlando, the shooting in Las Vegas, the shooting in Parkland. There's a mass shooting in this country almost every day. And so
I won't deny that fact, but again, the claim that guns cause violence is ridiculous. There's a lot of causes of violence. If you go after things that aren't the cause, you're not going to solve the violence. You need to solve the economic issues. You need to solve the issues around the war on drugs. If people weren't fighting over the drug trade, that would get rid of a lot of gun deaths.
Thanks, Ben. And I agree with you. You know, getting at the root causes of what causes people to erupt in violence is so important, and we've done a terrible job in this country of dealing with that, and we haven't done a good job here in Jacksonville. Let's take a few more calls. Scott is downtown. Hi, Scott.
Yes, good morning, everybody. Well, I kind of agree with the previous caller. It's not really the gun violence, and I deal with it all the time. What we have is a leadership problem, and we are in denial about the violence in this country. We need to go all the way back and see where it all begun. But my main point today here, we have a leadership problem here, not only in Jacksonville, but throughout this whole state of Florida, but mainly in North Florida. You have a very evil mayor and sheriff.
Why do you think they're evil?
Well, because the sheriff the mayor will come out and say the same thing over and over, and I have him on tape. He say the same thing over and over, and he come out here talking about the previous mayor, Brown, not getting the job done, but he come right back and do the exact same thing. And he not social and civic engaged in the community. And
okay.
I talk with him all the time.
All right, thanks, Scott. Okay, this does put more pressure on the mayor and the sheriff to deal with this problem. In fact, they were tweeting, Sheriff Williams was tweeting last night from Tampa, where he went over to support Ron DeSantis, who's campaigning for governor, as this was unfolding. So this is certainly politicized in this midterm election cycle in Florida right now.
It is even more ironic that Ron DeSantis was attacking Andrew Gillum about crime in Tallahassee when he's being supported by Mike Williams and Lenny Curry, whose own cities are reeling from gun violence.
Let me ask you as a follow-up, though. Here's an email for you from a listener. Many on the left think of President Trump as a Hitler-like person. Do we want to eliminate the Second Amendment and the right to own guns if you think you're going to have to deal with a Hitler? It did not work in Europe 80 years ago.
These are arguments. These are first of all, there are plenty of countries that are advanced democracies, do not have Second Amendment type rights on gun ownership, and they have not been changed into a tyranny. At the end of the day, the U.S. government, the federal government, has essentially monopoly on violence. If the government wants to be tyrannical, a few AR-15s in our home is not going to protect citizens. You know, it has awesome firepower. But that's not the way to protect a country from tyranny. The way to protect the country from tyranny is to go out and vote, is to go out and elect leaders who would not espouse tyrannical viewpoints. Guns are not going to protect us in that situation.
Certainly, though, a lot of Americans believe that that is the ultimate reason why they want to be armed. And we are a country born in revolution, so this goes so deep.
There are plenty of countries born in revolution. There are plenty of countries that have democratic rights. There are plenty of countries that elect bad leaders. This argument that guns are going to protect us from a tyranny, the idea that a good guy with a gun is going to stop a bad guy with a gun, is simply not borne out by data. Mother Jones did a study on 97 shootings, and they found out that people who were a shooter was stopped either by a trained police or some other intervention mechanism. The number of times a good guy with a gun stopped a bad guy with a gun was exactly zero in 97 shootings that was studied by the Mother Jones magazine. So these are not issues that can simply be argued on the basis of emotion. Simply look at the facts. I did not come to my conclusion about we should have a vigorous debate on the Second Amendment based on some idle thinking. I just simply looked at the facts, looked at the data, and simply asked the question, why are we such an exceptional nation with gun violence? You know, our rates of death because of guns far surpass the number of deaths in any other country in the world. Our gun ownership is off the charts. There are more guns in this country than people in this country. And so that begs the question, at what point do we say enough is enough? Either we need to regulate it through sensible, common sense regulation that both sides of this debate can agree on, such as universal background checks, ban on assault weapons, ban on certain types of gun magazines and bullets and that kind of stuff. Something that people from both sides of the political party agree on. Or we need to start a serious debate on, is the Second Amendment essentially a death wish on the country?
Well, on the other hand, actually, I won't say on the other hand. What I meant to say was, on another note, the topic that we had initially booked you to talk about this morning, let's move on and discuss that. A lot of people want to discuss guns and the Second Amendment, and I apologize to everyone who's on hold, but we want to make note of something else that's happening right now. The city of Jacksonville is accepting nearly $3 million, a grant from the United Arab Emirates. The UAE is giving Florida $10 million. To different cities that have been hit by Hurricane Irma. Now, here in Jacksonville, there was a lot of appreciation for this revenue. At the same time, there's been criticism. Even though the UAE has made this longstanding practice of delivering funds for storm relief, there are those who believe it's basically a distraction from the regime's horrible human rights record. Imprisonment of dissidents, the death penalty for anyone who disagrees with certain aspects of the government, the ongoing war in Yemen. And so the UAE is not a good actor, in other words. And so we've taken this money from them. What are your thoughts as a Middle East expert that we turn to?
Well, I mean, first of all, I appreciate any person or any group or any country that wants to help people in need. And I think my first instinct when I read the news was good. And when somebody wants to help other people who are in need. But unfortunately, the world is not as simple as that, because it is good. It is hard to reconcile between UAE's humanitarian initiatives and its entanglement in a variety of nefarious activities. It is somewhat challenging to think about that UAE is one of the primary causes of the violence in Yemen that is about to impoverish 13 million people. The famine the people of Yemen will face is unprecedented in the last 100-year history of global famines. 13 million people will be facing famine conditions this year. And UAE, along with Saudi Arabia, which is also on the news for all the wrong reasons, is the primary cause of that. So, but one of the things I also want to caution is that our foreign policy has always struggled between balancing between our interests and our values. And Trump, President Trump or anybody else is not the first president to have struggled with this issue. But while he's not the first president to struggle balancing between our values and our interests, he's certainly the first one to side with our interests over our values almost all of the time. In Russia, we have a reason to have meaningful security cooperation with Russia, but it does not mean that we turn a blind eye to its interference in our election. In North Korea, we have a reason to engage in dialogue with a nuclear-armed nation, but that does not mean we turn a blind eye to the regime's brutality and its endless list of human rights abuses. In Saudi Arabia, we have a reason to be friendly with a nation that supplies our vital interest of oil, but that does not mean we give it a pass when it murders a journalist or creates one of the largest man-made famines. And UAE falls under that category because UAE is complicit. Yeah,
the journalist Jamal Khashoggi from the Washington Post, that gruesome story we've all been following. Meanwhile, here's a tweet from Josh. The big question we should be asking is, what does it say about our city, state, and federal governments that Jacksonville has to resort to taking money from a Middle Eastern developing country in order to pay for basic hurricane disaster relief? Why do we, if we can't pay for this ourselves, what does that say, I think is what he's pointing out.
It does beg that question. I know there are other countries in the world who are not as wealthy as we are that reject foreign aid even during natural disasters. I'm talking about India, the country where I originally come from. India just experienced a horrible flood in southern India, and UAE made a gesture to make a donation for that flood relief, and the government of India rejected that donation. Partly because, you know, it does beg the question that if fellow citizens cannot support each other and help each other at their time of need, are turning to foreign sources of money. I mean, I can understand there are exceptions. There could be a catastrophic situation where it's a once in a lifetime type of a disaster, and then taking some foreign aid would alleviate some pain and suffering, and that would be understandable. But this one does not appear to be that kind of condition.
Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I was just going to make a comment regarding, you know, the gun violence issue, and I don't disagree with any of the facts that are out there about the number of shootings, but I'm curious about your guest's thoughts on the fact, if you will, that as recently as, say, you know, 30, 35 years or so ago, it was not uncommon to see guns in the gun racks in the back of pickup trucks on school property. There were weapons that were around everywhere, but it seems to me that it wasn't the weapons as much as our mentality, in that many individuals have a less sincere respect for life, a less respect for authority, for the law. And that, to me, seems more of the problem than it does an inanimate object. You know, I'm a gun owner, and not one of my guns has ever committed a crime. You know, I haven't. So I don't understand. I get the argument that he's trying to make about, you know, because there's more guns out there, you know, more violence is happening. But, you know, likewise, you could say that, you know, the fork that is in my kitchen drawer at home is making me fat. No, it's personal choices that where people go out and for whatever reason feel that gun violence is the solution to their own personal problems.
Thanks, Mark.
There is virtually no social science research that backs that up. That if we, there are, in that kind of an argument simply suggests that there is something that is innately problematic with American society, that is unique to American society, that we are susceptible to this kind of gun violence, that we as Americans cannot control our emotions. We have social problems that no other country in the world faces. We have challenges like every other place in the world. Yes, social problems do exasperate the gun violence, but the easy availability of guns makes that violence more lethal. As you cited the example of Las Vegas or Pulse or Parkland, it's simply the lethality of it. It's like now we have guns that are that can kill in literally in seconds, in minutes. Hundreds of people could be affected by violence. So, yeah, and by the way, the mass shootings, as horrible as they are, And they, as you mentioned, the statistics, almost one mass shooting per day. Only a handful of them make national coverage and big splashes across
and
the
media.
And
they're not the majority of fatal shootings in this country.
Yes. Yeah. And also
the majority of fatal shootings are via handguns.
Via handguns, yeah. Suicides, spousal violence, violence from loved ones. It simply makes it much more easier to have a kind of violence that in most circumstances is irreversible. If you can have violence with a knife, you can have violence with other objects, but there is nothing like violence with a gun.
Speaking of violence with knives, you also wanted to weigh in about the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Mm-hmm. And the latest on that.
Well, I mean, this is bizarre. It is bizarre and beyond belief. But I think Saudi Arabia has received a pass for a long time. I look at this myself as a practicing Muslim who has visited Saudi Arabia for my pilgrimage several times. And I reflect back on my own experience being there. And after the Jamal Khashoggi incident, I wrote an op-ed that got quite a bit of a social media stir. And the title of the op-ed says it's all, that it's time to boycott Saudi Arabia. It's time. And I write it as, I did not write it from an American foreign policy perspective, which I do intend to write a little bit later, as I wanted to first this news to kind of settle and see where all of the chips fall. But even based on what we know right now, given Saudi Arabia's complicity in 9/11, given Saudi Arabia's complicity in the ongoing humanitarian disaster in Yemen, and certainly with this the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist working for an American newspaper, I think Saudi Arabia has crossed the line. And while the foreign policy issues will work out in its due course, and I understand the challenges that foreign policy establishment faces, constantly trying to balance between our interests and our values. And it does present a challenge. On one hand, Saudi Arabia is supplying a vital need for our country with its oil supply. But on the other hand, it is engaged in gross human rights abuses for a very, very long period of time. And we have constantly turned a blind eye.
Looked the other way.
Yeah. So the question right now is, as ordinary citizens, what can be my response? So I looked at myself and I said, what would be my response at this time? And my response at this time would be, I would not go for another pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia. I do not want to be complicit in another regime's violence. Saudi Arabia makes about $9 billion per year on its annual pilgrimage.
And from people traveling to Mecca and Medina.
Right.
Yeah.
That's just during the annual pilgrimage.
The Hajj. Call it.
And then there is something called the Umrah, which is a minor pilgrimage. A minor pilgrimage meaning that it is done at other times in the year and it is not as elaborate as the main Hajj pilgrimage. And that draws about 19 million people. And Saudi Arabia is on target to make about $150 billion from these pilgrimages by the year 2026, I think. So this is a significant amount of revenue to a country that my fellow Muslims are supplying to fulfill their religious obligation.
And you're saying, don't go.
At least now. At least there is, at this moment in time, if you have to express your outrage at the ongoing situation, one way to do it as an ordinary citizen, whether you are in the U.S. or any other place in the world, is to withhold that support. It is a difficult thing. On one hand, it's a religious obligation. On the other hand, you are faced with the religious dictum of being just and standing up for justice, which the Quran also exhorts believers to. So it is a balancing act. And at this moment in time, my argument is that it is better to not spend that money and go to Hajj. It is better to take that money and help the victims of the Saudi regime in Yemen. That would be a much better, in my view, a much better way of fulfilling God's divine commands than going for a pilgrimage.
UNF's Parvez Ahmed, always good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, still ahead, the Jaguars bench Blake Bortles as they see their third straight loss. But up next, as Florida's candidates for governor debate, a new app helps you connect with political leaders. We'll tell you about that right after this. We'll be right back.
WJCT readers are here for you. With the Florida Times Union, complete with news, op-eds, and obits, our readers will bring the paper to life to serve those with blindness and other physical challenges. Need our service? Go online to wjct.org/radio reading. Listen there and register as a listener, or we'll send you a special radio free. Call us at 904-358-6308, because at Radio Reading, we give voice to the printed word.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. You know 630 City? It's the familiar place you go when you need to know. During severe weather conditions, our 630 City Call Center operates around the clock, equipping citizens with information they may need to make decisions and resolve issues. Be sure to add their number, 630 City, to your favorites, and remember to pick up a 2018 Hurricane Preparedness Guide from your neighborhood public library. Be Jack's ready.
Well, last night, the two candidates for Florida governor, Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis, had a contentious debate on CNN. They disagreed on basically everything, including their approach to the environment.
Well, I'm endorsed by the Everglades Trust. That's the gold standard. I'm one of the few Republicans that's been able to do it. I have the scars from fighting this fight. And when he talks about these environmental votes, I don't want to shut down like the coal industry in West Virginia. For Florida, I've always been there, whether it's Everglades restoration, whether it's fighting toxic algae, whether it's fighting the red tide. I've been there every step of the way, and that's why I've been recognized, and that's why I've been endorsed. And Andrew has not.
The board of the Everglades Foundation is made up of three people. That same board gave $250,000 to the Republican Party of the state of Florida. And one of the three board members then dissented and joined me. I'm endorsed by a number of environmental organizations, some of the national leading ones, because of my record. Not what I'm saying in a campaign, but what I've actually done as mayor.
Well, early voting begins today here in Duval County for the upcoming midterm election. So get out and vote. Now, there's another way to get politically engaged and connect with elected officials. Guess what? There's an app for that. The new political action app, Capital Call, helps you connect with everyone from, say, Mayor Lenny Curry to your congressman and more. Capital Call has been honored as Apple's App of the Day and one of Apple's top 20 influencers of app culture. Matt White is Director of Partnerships and Outreach for the Capital Call app and joins us now. Good morning.
Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
So this is a good time for people to download this app. We are in a really hot political season. How did Capital Call come to be?
Absolutely. Well, we kind of got started after the 2016 election. People were looking for a way to take some political action, and you kind of need to go where the people are. So we figured that was your cell phone in 2018 now. Mm-hmm. So on the app, you can register to vote. Not anymore. The deadline has passed in Florida. Yeah. But we can also let you know about your registration status and help you find your polling location. And like you said, it's October 22nd. Early voting has opened all the way through the 4th.
And if people download this app, they can actually do outreach. They can connect with their elected officials through the app.
That's right. So in addition to our voting registration efforts, we also have what we like to call mobile advocacy. And what that is allows people to make campaigns, another word there, that is, you know, something that they're passionate about. And it's presented to our users in a type of Instagram or Facebook style feed of political actions. And then users of the app can click on those and take tangible political steps.
Like what? But you can write your congressman? You can what?
You can go old school and send an email. Email is old school these days. We can also power tweet storms, which seems to be the modus operandi as well for a lot of political campaigns. And then we got good old-fashioned phone calls. And we have research that shows the phone call to your senator is still one of the most powerful tools we have.
That's what I've heard, too, that they will pay a lot more attention to the volume of calls than emails or tweets,
although Absolutely.
You should do those too.
Yes. Yeah, both are great ways to get in touch. But the nice thing about a phone call and the namesake of our app, Capital Call, is that the staffers actually sit there and calculate out who's calling and about what, even if you leave a voicemail.
Now, Capital Call has been honored, as I said, as Apple's App of the Day and one of Apple's top 20 apps. How did you get that award?
Absolutely. We were actually kind of organically recognized as we built the app. We were noticed by Apple, and Apple had a number of political-based campaigns. They saw us, and they liked what we're doing, and they recognized us.
So you're based here in Jacksonville. Any more app development in your future?
I think we're going to continue to work on Capital Call for now. My partner is actually in Seattle, Washington as well. So we work remotely together across the country. And like we say, you know, both really important states for voting. So we like to be always talking about it together.
People can download Capital Call app from their Play Store. Free app?
Free app.
All right. Download Capital Call, the app that gets you plugged into politics. Matt White is Director of Partnerships and Outreach for the Capital Call app, the award-winning app. Congratulations.
Thank you, Melissa.
Still to come, Culpepper as the Jaguars lose at home. But up next, a unique way to reduce stress. We'll tell you about that in just a moment.
Discover new music at the Electro Lounge Monday through Saturday nights at 9, only on 89.9 FM. We've got your chill. Tune in and enjoy fresh music from around the world.
Well, if you are feeling stressed out these days, you're not alone. 68% of Americans say they're stressed on a weekly basis, that according to a new survey. Women in particular report high levels of stress, everything from finances to health concerns, issues with children, work, their to-do list. You know, there are so many sources of stress, and finding relief can be tough. However, one local researcher says there's a surprisingly simple way to cool out. Flowers. Yeah, flowers. Dr. Aaron Largo-White, a UNF Associate Professor of Public Health, has studied this and has found that living with flowers alleviates your daily stress. Dr. Largo-White, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I think this is something a lot of women know instinctively, but you've proved it. How did you do this study?
Yeah, so our research is in a new area of public health called health by design, which is all about creating healthy, restorative environments to reduce stress. In this study, we focused on exploring the impact of flowers. And what we found was that women living with flowers, even just for a few days, had a significant reduction in their stress levels.
And so it's important to have fresh cut flowers in your home.
Well, according to the findings of this study, yes.
According to this study.
But we also know that in general, bringing nature in, bringing the outdoors in is an important way to create those moments of calm and those restorative environments that can help reduce stress. For example, we know from past findings that having a potted plant in your home, having natural sunlight, even listening to recorded nature sounds has been shown to reduce stress and promote health. So it made sense to us that flowers would also reduce stress.
When I was just starting out and I had no money at all, I would always say, well, you're never too broke for good wine and fresh flowers.
Yes, exactly, right.
And now that, many years later, I still like fresh flowers. It's just then what happens is there's a chemical reaction in the body, right? Mm-hmm. Your cortisol, your stress hormone goes down.
Right, exactly. So nature contact, we know that either going outdoors, for example, and having that breath of fresh air can be something that's restorative and actually changes our physiology in our body to reduce our stress. But we can also mimic that in our indoor environments. And our indoor environments are important to consider because we spend 90% of our time indoors, either at home or at work or wherever we may be. So thinking about ways to design those spaces so that they are restorative and so that we are thriving is important.
So having plants or flowers is one way. Are there any other tips you have for those stressed women and men out there?
Yes. There are other ways that in your indoor space that you can increase that, the bringing the outdoors in. You can open your blinds. You can position your workstation so that you have a view to be able to see outdoors. Bringing those plants, bringing flowers. There's even research to suggest that having fish tanks is something that's restorative. Having those water element kind of things.
Any kind of water element will work, won't it?
Yes.
Like a little fountain or a little water garden.
Yes.
You can buy those anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. So having that sound or having the water element nearby could potentially reduce stress as well.
This all seems so obvious, but people don't always think of it. And then they look around and they're, you know, their blood pressure is through the roof. They can't sleep well. There are simple ways to bring that serenity to your environment.
Right. Yes. And I really like this research because it's a simple solution that people can do to reduce their stress. So compared to other things that we also know can help reduce stress, such as training your problem solving so you can better deal with issues, those are so hard and so time consuming, take tremendous effort. It's just thinking about our environment and ways to make more calming, restorative spaces is an important thing for us to consider.
This is such a fascinating study. It's out of UNF, the impact of flowers on perceived stress among women. So buy a bouquet of flowers for the woman in your life today. She will be very grateful. And always good to get the research from the University of North Florida. Thank you so much for joining us. She's Dr. Erin Largo White, Associate Professor of Public Health at UNF. Mm-hmm. I feel less stressed already.
There we go.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And you can catch Dr. White on River City Live later this morning. She's headed over there. In a moment, the Jaguars bench Blake Bortles in their third straight loss. Ouch. Cole Pepper has sound from the locker room and more sports news and notes. Coming up after the break.
Next Fresh Air, Melissa McCarthy.
Quite by accident, I find myself in a rather criminal position.
McCarthy stars in the new film, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, as a biographer turned literary forger. We'll talk about the film, growing up on a farm, her early comedy act, her role in Bridesmaids, and playing Sean Spicer on Saturday Night Live. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Across the country, colleges are beginning to offer students Narcan in case they need to reverse an opioid overdose.
We felt that it was on the university to provide these because it's a life-saving drug, and we're in the midst of an epidemic that affects everybody.
Others question if it could encourage drug use. That story, plus the fallout from Jamal Khashoggi's death, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT.
Florida was an important training ground during World War II, and the population of the state exploded after the war. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the World War II exhibit at the Museum of Florida History in Tallahassee. We'll discuss early soil survey maps and Florida's first professional football team. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Teachers were on strike, hotel workers are on strike, and labor unions are still reeling from a Supreme Court ruling this summer. How are local laws impacting those who organize for better wages and working conditions? Ahead of the midterms, we look at the right to work and union rights. Our special series, The State We're In, continues next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, finally, this hour, the Jaguars bench Blake Bortles over the weekend in their third straight loss.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
20-7 as Houston rolled over Jacksonville at home yesterday. Ouch. Cole Pepper, were you at the game?
Of course.
Yes.
And watching what was going on, Melissa, you just started thinking, well, how much longer can they go without doing something? And Doug Marrone had the same kind of feeling. So in the third quarter, after Blake Bortles had fumbled the ball away for the second time, I looked down on the sideline, and while Houston was going in for a touchdown, there was Cody Kessler with his helmet on, warming up. Bortles had a ball cap, and we knew it was about to happen, the benching of Blake Bortles. Now, whether this is a long-term deal or a short-term deal is another story. Marrone said after the game that he wanted to find a spark and that he was going to reevaluate everybody and every position after this three-game losing skid. So there's certainly still a possibility that Bortles could be back in there. And my gut tells me that because of the schedule and where we are and a couple of other factors, I think Bortles is going to wind up starting again on Sunday in London against the Philadelphia Eagles. Here's why. First of all, I don't think anybody looks at Cody Kessler as a quarterback of the future. He's a backup quarterback, has some good skills, is an accurate passer. That certainly plays into his favor. One of the things that led to the benching was too many turnovers. Doug Marrone has been preaching, taking care of the football. He knows that his team right now doesn't have the weapons, doesn't have all the top guys on offense, and they need to win games, you know, 15-10, that sort of thing. And giving the ball away, absolutely, he's going to kill you in the NFL, particularly if your offense is not high-powered. So I think they're going to go back with Bortles because it's a little bit of a shorter week with longer travel to London, plus you have a bye week afterwards. The other thing to consider is this. If the Jaguars were to go with Cody Kessler and he doesn't work out, well, you don't have any other options. You've got a rookie, Tanner Lee, on the practice squad, but you're going to go back to Bortles then? I think you stay with Bortles until he's not your quarterback anymore, and you just say, hey, listen, we were just looking for a spark, and as Marrone said yesterday after the game, he can't bench everybody,
yeah. So
he had to get somebody's attention. But the offense went scoreless for a third straight first half, first time ever in the franchise that that's happened. Jaguars have now lost two games in the AFC South. Both of the games have been at home to the Titans and Texans. That puts them behind the eight ball. And for the first time since Doug Marrone took over as a head coach, the Jaguars have a losing record under Marrone. It's the most adversity they have faced in Marrone's tenure. And frustrations boiled over on the sideline and in the locker room. The most visibly upset player was defensive end Yannick Ngakoue, who was seen on the sideline shouting at coaches and being restrained by a teammate. After the game, as the locker room doors were open to allow reporters in, and Ngakoue was seen being restrained by fellow defensive lineman Calais Campbell. The doors were then closed before reporters later went back into the locker room. The loss follows a week when Doug Marrone ramped up the intensity of practice and focused on a return to the basics. The Jaguars responded with that third straight scoreless first half for the first time in history. Mm-mm-mm. So this coming week, the Jaguars' annual trip to London is certainly going to test the resolve of the team. With such high expectations at the beginning of the season, the Jaguars are facing the most adversity in this in Marrone's tenure, and this is what the players had to say, particularly the defensive stars, after the game.
I walk in here, y'all see how it is in here. Y'all see how we vibe with each other. Y'all see how we vibe towards the coaches. Y'all see how it is. There's no secret what's going on here right now. Ain't nobody gonna say it because, you know, we can't, but ain't no secret what's going on. It ain't right now. So.
Frustration's a part of the game. I mean, we're emotional people in this emotional game. At the same time, you know, I think that these guys, this group of guys, you know, we have a different kind of heart to us, you know. And at the same time, you know, I mean, losing sucks, you know, especially losing three in a row. You know, I mean, you want to stack wins, you know. And, I mean, stacking losses, that's not who we are. That's not what we want to be. But, I mean, it is who we are because that's what's going on right now. But I do believe that we will get it fixed. You know, we have no choice but to get it fixed.
Just got to keep guys together. You know, and this is a message that I said to the guys is we're going to see who love the game right now. We're going to see who love this team, who love this organization, who love each other. Because we're going to have the battle dig deep. We done dug ourselves in the hole. It's going to take a lot to dig us out.
That's Jalen Ramsey, Calais Campbell, and Telvin Smith at the end, all three defensive players. One of the questions I really have right now is where's the leadership going to come from on offense? You've got if Blake Bortles is benched, there's one captain. Leonard Fournette, the other offensive captain, is out with the injury. Brandon Linder, the center, who was a captain last year, not as vocal a guy, although I think he'll provide some level of leadership. You don't have Mercedes Lewis. You don't have Marquise Lee. So there's a real lack of established leadership on the field, on the offensive side of the football, as the Jaguars prepare to play the Super Bowl champions in London on Sunday.
That's going to be an interesting trip. Now let's talk college football. It is Florida-Georgia week. The RV City will be springing up around this building at any moment now.
I noticed you just said Florida-Georgia week. Oh. I'm calling it Georgia-Florida week, and here's why. You're going to, you know, everybody wants their team mentioned first for some reason, like that has something to do with anything. But I am going by the old rule of whoever won last year gets said first.
Okay.
So if things turn this year, and it certainly could happen, it'll be Florida-Georgia next week. But this is the first time since 1999 that both teams are ranked in the top 10 for this matchup. People ask me who maybe don't know my college affiliation, who do you root for? And I always say, I'm rooting for Florida and Georgia to come to Jacksonville undefeated. I think it'd be a great scene. This is as close as we've come in a long time to that. It's going to have, you know, College Game Day is going to be here. The SEC Network's bringing Tim Tebow in. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a big day.
The whole shebang.
Yeah, the social scene is always a big deal, but this also will include a football game that really could influence not only the SEC East race, but also the national title picture.
All right, and FSU beat Wake Forest Saturday. You can follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper for all of your sports news and notes. Always good to see you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Michelle Quorum is our director. 1A is up next. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. This is 89.9. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.